Welcome to Award Wieners. I'm your co-host, John, joined by the rose-growing station master, David, who's going through a phase. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, David and I discuss the World War II family drama, Mrs. Miniver, winner of the 1942 Oscar for Outstanding Motion Picture. Dave, how's it going?
John, did you know that when I was little, I wanted to be a train conductor?
I did not know that.
I had a little train conductor hat. I would wear it around.
All aboard, says Dave.
All aboard the podcast. Choo choo. I'm in Cincinnati. What's going on with you?
I am not in Cincinnati. I'm still in D.C. What is going on with me? So I have a little anecdote that I found funny. Not everyone found funny in this anecdote. I was going to New Jersey with the lady I'm dating. She's like, oh, we should have created a playlist for the weekend, you know, our way up. I'm like, that's a good idea. I'll create one now. The first song I picked to New Jersey, The Highway to Hell by AC/DC.
I think that's funny.
I didn't realize this. She's a little sensitive about how people talk about New Jersey having gotten it for the past 20 years.
What do people say about New Jersey? I'm familiar with what people say about Florida, but not Jersey.
Jersey Shore, fist pumping, gym tan laundry, those kind of things.
Is it America's armpit?
It could be, and Florida is America's wang.
It's its taint.
It's its unwashed taint.
I want to describe for our audience where I'm recording at. So I am staying at my parents' place for a week. I'm visiting my family. I am in an unfinished basement, basically in the dark. I literally have a kerosene lamp I have dedicated to this podcast.
Which ties into this movie. You're like in a bunker in World War II.
The whole point of me telling you, describing this for everyone, is that I'm going to sound a little bit echoey because I literally don't have any choice. This it. It's either this or my parents will be in the background listening to CNN.
This is CNN.
It's just the same like five conversations with different people all day.
Kind of like us.
What hot dog did you eat today? I don't know.
That's a good segue into that. So, Dave, we watched Mrs. Miniver, which is a World War II family drama. How would you describe this movie?
So I would describe it as an English family comes to the grips with the changes in their lives caused by the outbreak of World War II. How would you describe it?
I'd say a small British community slowly realizes the war raging outside of its borders will soon come home to roost. If you're a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. Dave, how was your dog dressed this evening for Mrs. Miniver?
Very fancy, John. Very fancy.
Before you go into it, I think you should introduce why you chose this.
Miss Miniver is both the name of the main character and it's also the name of a flower in the movie. A rose, to be specific. So I wanted to incorporate rose water into my ingredients. I can tell you right now, it was not a smart idea. But what I did was that I made a rose water honey glaze and put that over my hot dog. So it's just a plain hot dog with really a honey rose glaze. I don't like rose water, so I screwed up. Maybe you'll like this recipe. I did not. John, what do you have?
Well, I have a look on my face right now. Thinking about your rose water hot dog is what I have. It's not like something savory and sweet at the same time.
I know people who really love rose water. I'm just not one of them.
It has its place, but not on a hot dog, it sounds like.
Can't bat 1,000, okay?
I'm going to bat 1,000 with this pick, though. So I've chosen bangers and mash. And I don't even know if I've used this before, but it's just a British staple. So it's basically a sausage and mashed potatoes. I think it actually is excellent. This actually was a dish that came to be in World War I when meat supplies were running low. So they upped the water content in the sausage a little bit, which gives it a slightly less dry consistency. And honestly, I think it's probably one of my favorite British or Irish meals that exists.
Do you know what type of sausage that is? Is it just banger sausage?
It's usually chicken or lamb, I believe. That's what a banger sausage is made of. And some spices. I don't know what the spices are exactly. But there's like an Irish version and a British version, but they're very similar.
I've had Irish bangers and mash, and I like it. So good pick, John. Way better than my rose water hot dog.
Not this time.
I thought about boiling the hot dog in rose water. I didn't do that.
I always find rose water to be like so light. Like it's like barely noticeable, but I never put it on a hot dog. So it does not hot dog, apparently.
This is another good segue into food facts. I'm going to talk about rose water. Roses in general, but the question I had was like, could you eat roses? And the answer is yes, but sparingly. It's used as sort of a garnish. And there's really a long history of eating roses and using rose flavoring, mostly because there's supposedly some health benefits with it. I started to look up what's the most common way to use roses in cooking. It's rose water. But I did find an interesting recipe that took a couple rose petals and mashed them up with a mortar and pestle and included it in dishes. So like an example of this would be Persian stuffed dumplings with squash. I don't think I'm going to be ordering this anytime soon, but people have been doing it forever. It can be done.
Well, I've got some history for us with some food facts also. I was kind of just looking at what people were eating in World War II in England. The population actually ate pretty well. The country had started rationing things in advance of the war. They kind of knew things were not going to go well. There had been a blockade that they kind of saw coming, prevented ships from coming into the island, so they actually stocked up several years in advance, having seen the war raging in Europe. But that doesn't mean things weren't hard to come by. People joined something known as pig clubs, where you would buy a portion of a pig being raised, and you would keep your food scraps, which would then be fed to the animal. So this was probably done in a neighborhood. They did the same thing for chickens, and then also rabbits became something that people were growing and eating as well. But you had to give up your food rations for meat if you were doing this. But you were often given something else as a substitute. Gardens were also very common and expected during the war. There was actually a rationing campaign that took place and stayed in place until 1950 in England, when the British government finally felt that food stocks were replenished. I have a really good article, a really in-depth article on this that we will share on Facebook and our website if you want to learn more.
I was thinking that going up to 1950 seems like a long time, but I have to remember that they were hit very hard.
It's really only 5 years after the war ended, but not too long. I mean, it is much longer than you would anticipate.
I also like the idea of a pig club. I know my family has done something similar with like a cow. Let's jump into movie facts. This movie was released June 4th, 1942 in the U.S. of A. Its runtime is 133 minutes. The budget was $1.3 million. At the box office, it made $8.8 million. It was directed by William Wyler, and it was nominated for 12 awards, and it won 6. Those awards were Outstanding Motion Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Writing, Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Black and White. This went up against The Invaders, King's Row, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Pied Piper, The Pride of the Yankees, Random Harvest, The Talk of the Town, Wake Island, and Yankee Doodle Dandy. That was a mouthful.
Have you seen any of those, Dave?
I have seen parts of Yankee Doodle Dandy, and I remember seeing parts of The Pride of the Yankees. I don't quite remember them very well. Have you seen any of these movies, John?
I haven't. I don't think.
Do you know about any of them?
Nope.
From what I understand when looking them up, they're all very patriotic.
I mean, every single title has a military name in it. You're like, Pride of the Yankees, Wake Island, Yankee Doodle Dandy, The Invaders. So every single one of those, you know, has something to do with the war.
Mostly. Not all of them. I don't think The Magnificent Andersons does.
Gotcha. So this, interestingly enough, leads us into our cast and crew facts. I want to talk about the director a little bit, specifically William Wyler. He had 13 actors and actresses who won an Oscar under his direction. He did Ben-Hur, which we already talked about, and another World War II drama, The Best Years of Our Lives. So that's about coming back from the war and how veterans dealt with their life back as civilians. We'll do that one eventually. He won 4 Oscars in his life, and this is what I think is kind of interesting. So he joined the Air Force in the war and actually created some of the most memorable footage of World War II air combat. He actually went up in bombers and filmed bombing runs in dangerous situations. The military hired him to basically create newsreels and propaganda. He did this wanting to be patriotic and wanting to do something for his country. You know, he was a little bit older at the time, so he wasn't sure what to do with himself. He couldn't exactly enlist, but this is what he did instead. He actually went deaf flying in a giant flying fortress of some kind. So the engines were so loud, he went up. And when he came down, he never regained his hearing again.
Wow.
So he actually directed Ben-Hur after that happened.
Maybe that's why the acting in that movie is so bad.
So wooden.
Yeah.
So just some other points to make. I'm going to quickly cover some of the actors and actresses in this movie. They're not really that famous, and they didn't really do much else except for maybe one or two of the actors slash actresses. The first actor I want to mention is Henry Travers. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his role as this train station master and a gardener. He's probably most recognizable for his role in It's a Wonderful Life. So he's the angel that's talking to Jimmy Stewart in that movie. There's also Greer Garson, and she won Best Actress for her role as Mrs. Miniver. She was actually nominated for Best Actress 7 times, but this was her only win. And she was actually considered one of the biggest box office draws of the 1940s. Then there was Walter Pidgeon. Not known for much of anything other than he was nominated for his role as Mr. Miniver. There's Richard Ney, who actually played the Miniver's son in this movie, Vin. He was actually married to his co-star, Greer Garson, who played his mother in this movie after this flick. So that's like a weird twist there, marrying your mother.
She was 10 years older than him. I looked that up. I'm sure people had questions. It's the first one I had.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. And then there's Teresa Wright, who may have been one of the better actresses of the movie. She won Best Supporting Actress for her role as Carol, and she's the granddaughter of the local lady, and by that I mean she's part of the aristocracy. She was also in the Best Picture winner, Best Years of Our Lives, the other Wyler World War II drama that we'll eventually do, and was also in Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt. Dave, you have some movie trivia facts for us.
I do. So this was based on a book released in 1939, and the book, it was essentially a collection of vignettes and short snippets. I hesitate to quite call them stories that had appeared in a bunch of magazines. A sequel to this called The Miniver Story was released in 1950, and it picks up on VE Day, and that's Victory in Europe Day. Miss Miniver has had an emotional affair with another man and has been diagnosed with a terminal condition with only a year left to live. Vin isn't in this movie, most likely because that actor and Miss Miniver had been married and divorced in that time period.
That's what happens when you get involved with your co-stars, especially your mom. Probably grounded him.
The vicar's final rousing speech in this movie was printed in magazines like Time and Look, and President Franklin Roosevelt ordered that it be broadcast on Voice of America, and copies of it were dropped over Europe as propaganda. The speech has gone on to be known as the Wilcoxon speech. And then finally, Churchill declared that this movie did more for the Allies than a flotilla of battleships.
Kind of amazing in many different ways.
I didn't know anything about this film, and it was very well loved for when it came out. All right, John, so do you have some history for us?
This is a movie that we definitely want to put into context so that you better understand what was going on in 1942. Prior to this, there was Kristallnacht, which was German paramilitary Nazis and civilians stormed Jewish neighborhoods around Germany, killing 91 Jews and destroying hundreds of businesses. This motivated the director, Wyler, to use his money he made in Hollywood to help save people. He spent much of his wealth actually doing this, trying to bring people out of Germany. From July of 1940 to May of 1941, Germany launched large-scale night attacks on England. This campaign was known as the Battle of Britain. The campaign consisted of bombing runs done by a few planes at all hours of the day, targeting economic centers and airfields. And then they had nighttime destroyer bombing runs on urban areas. So that was just to disrupt civilian life, make everyone miserable, and they hoped that they could eventually force England to surrender because they felt it would be very difficult to do a land invasion. The United States, during all of this, had kind of taken this isolationist approach, not wanting to get involved in the wars raging in Asia, Europe, and North Africa. When this movie started production in 1939, the U.S. had not entered the war yet and would not until the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. Wyler wanted to make a movie to convince the American public that his isolationist stance on the war was a wrong one and that if they did not combat the Nazis, they would take over the world. This movie is largely an allegory, showing how people need to work together to overcome an evil as large as the Nazis.
So I read a lot about World War II when I did my thesis, and I think it might be interesting just to add that the isolationists, one of the main arguments at the time was that they didn't think the aircrafts could make it all the way across the ocean to the United States. So that was one of the major arguments. They didn't think the war was going to come to America. All right, so let's do this movie. Let's get into this bad boy.
All right. So we're on the cusp of World War II in England. We are outside of London. The first part of the film is concerned with the Miniverse. They're an upper-middle-class family, and they are definitely involved with their community.
They come from good stock.
So the film opens up with Mrs. Miniver, and again, that's played by Greer Garson, seated on a train. She suddenly rushes out of the train as if something is terribly wrong. She is on a shopping trip in London, and she's decided that the impulse buy that she avoided earlier, this expensive hat, is something that she wants. So she picks it up, takes it with her. As Mrs. Miniver is heading home, the station master, Mr. Ballard, who is again played by Henry Travers, pulls her aside in this kind of awkward moment and shows her a rose that he's growing for the local gardening contest. He asks her if he can name it after her, the Miniver Rose, in honor of the lovely lady who is so nice to him every day. Mr. Ballard plans on entering this rose in the local rose growing competition. Dave, do you want to describe this scene?
So I'll describe Miss Miniver. From the outset, she seems kind of frivolous, but also kind. She's very, very friendly, very sweet. It's hard to get a feel for her personally. Like, I had a difficult time with her throughout the film. I never felt negatively towards her, but I also was like, don't have a lot of like strong traits to latch onto.
She's pretty bland as a character, honestly. Like, she's like a nice person who's confident. There's not a lot of traits that stand out in her, as far as I can tell.
Now, Mr. Ballard, again, he's also kind of bland, but the one thing that he's doing is he's sort of standing up to the ladyship by having this rose and wanting to enter it into a contest. Not super quirky, but, you know, a little bit. Let's describe this scene, because I think this is really strange. It took me 4 or 5 times to get through this. I really had a hard time with this movie. The first time I stopped it was at this scene.
So you made it like 3 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, I was like, what the hell is this? And I turned it off. Because this scene is super, super awkward. And maybe it's just because of our modern standards. But naming a rose after a woman that you don't know really well seems strange. It seems like I thought he'd be hitting on her, and he wasn't.
It does come across that way at first, because he runs into her at the station. He's the station master. And he says, Mrs. Miniver, I'd like to take you aside for a moment. Do you have a minute to come with me? And it's like, well, this is like a pretty big demand from the station master, but maybe contextually things are different for us because I don't really talk to the station masters when I'm on the train, but I'm also not on the train every day, and it's a smaller community, so maybe they actually know each other and have some sort of relationship where it would be okay to ask or make that request.
I don't know. If I was him, I would have saved up that ticket for someone you liked. I would have used it on the woman he was sweet on.
He's an old man. Is there a woman that he was sweet on in town?
Just because you're an old man doesn't mean you don't want to, you know, have someone in your life. So moving on to the next segment. In the next scene, it's evening, and we meet Mr. Miniver. Mr. Miniver is in the process of purchasing a car that he knows is too expensive for him, and he's waffling back and forth with the car salesman. So it's very similar to what his wife was doing earlier. Ultimately, he decides to purchase that vehicle. John, so what are we supposed to take away from this duality, these two scenes back-to-back of Mr. and Mrs. Miniver both buying things that they probably shouldn't?
I think it just means that they're comfortable in life and can do these things. They're both kind of impulse buys and they're not necessary, but again, they can just do it because they have the means to do it. But I think we also heard see that they're involved with lots of people in their community, and I think that's kind of what it's establishing. They're well-to-do and well-liked.
I saw it as them not having a lot of actual cares. Their life is based around, you know, getting commodities that they don't really need but they want, and this was being used to set up to how their life changed later in the film.
Yes, I agree. So soon after the new car is purchased, the Miniverse pick up their eldest son, Vin, played by Richard Ney, who's been away studying at Oxford. So Dave, what do you notice immediately here?
He has a pipe, and he talks very eruditely. He's putting on airs is what I would call it. What am I supposed to notice?
I would say, what about the age difference between Mrs. Miniver and Vin?
I didn't notice. What am I supposed to notice?
Well, they married each other in real life, Dave.
They did, and he's 10 years younger.
So, like, she is a 30-something-year-old lady with a 22-year-old son. Doesn't really match up. So Mr. Miniver is either a real creep or the casting was off.
I read somewhere that she was worried about taking this role because she didn't think she could play a mid-40s woman. She thought she was too young.
I think she plays the role okay, but it's weird because like half the cast is her age too, and they're supposed to be like her children, basically.
Okay. I didn't notice that, but clearly you did, so I think maybe our audience will.
So in the next scene, we see that Carol Belden, played by Teresa Wright, the granddaughter of the local aristocrat Lady Belden, visits the Minivers and asks Mrs. Miniver if she would dissuade Mr. Ballard, who's the station master, from entering his rose in the contest because winning this contest means so much to her elderly grandmother. Her grandmother has entered the rose contest every year for like 40 years and won it every year, in large part because no one else has ever entered. This causes a bit of a stir, both in the circle here listening to this request and in town. Vin takes this, Vin again being back from college and on his high horse, having just read two books on philosophy, that this is the ruling class trying to exert its control over the commoners. Carol counters that for all of Vin's ideas, he's not doing anything to change the world. While she actually is, because she's like off volunteering at places and doing all sorts of stuff. So she's not just some single lady spending her parents' money.
Okay, John. I stopped the movie twice at this point. Second and third ones. This is where I stopped. Both times. That's because basically Vin's not wrong. Carol's argument holds no weight here. She's arguing something completely different than what Vin is saying. What made me really infuriated was his dad was like, yeah, she handled him really well. It's like, no, she didn't. She didn't actually make an argument.
Well, I mean, he is kind of coming at her and doesn't really know her, like, pretty much right off the bat.
It doesn't make his argument wrong. His argument, I think, is correct. People should be allowed to enter this contest because it's supposed to be free and open. She didn't have any conversation about that. She just said, well, you're not doing anything in your life. That's just attacking him and not the argument.
Oh, I agree with that. But at the same time, I think she's also saying, well, what are you going to do about it? And he hasn't thought of what that next step is. That's where he is in his education and life. He's just coming across these new ideas. It still really hasn't crystallized in his mind on what he should be doing about it. So other than just talking, I think she's encouraging him to take action.
There's two things here that I just kind of thought of. The first is, how old is Carol? Kind of feels like an enigma. She has to be around Vin's age.
Right. Well, so is Mrs. Miniver.
So is everyone, apparently.
Yeah.
Except that 5-year-old. Yep. I guess the other thing I was thinking about, we didn't get to touch on, I find Vin insufferable through this film. All the way through.
He is like an obnoxious kid, basically. Which is not untrue. Because he's probably like 20, 21, something like that, right?
I didn't even think he was that old. I thought he was like 19.
I mean, that would make sense, too. Describe Carol, too.
So Carol is smart. She is charming. She might be the best part of this film. Doesn't take any bullshit. As you can tell, I like her.
There's a lot of strong women in this movie, especially for the time. Mrs. Miniver is very independent, doing her own thing, and so is Carol. So I think they're also, in a way, showing some societal shifts in a woman's place. Because they're not like the women hanging out in the kitchen and like doing these things or raising a family necessarily. Like they're out in the community making decisions, helping people, saving lives, and kind of being badasses generally.
So one thing I just realized is that Carol didn't know the Minivers. That's weird, right? She just showed up to the house like, I'm here because my grandmother wants to win this contest. I don't know you actually, but can you help me out?
Or I feel like maybe they knew her, but they hadn't seen her in like 10 years. You know, like one of those things. Like she was the neighbor girl or whatever.
Wouldn't you just go to the station master and ask him not to do it?
Dave, it's polite society. They're not allowed to do that. They have to work in subterfuge.
I feel like as Americans, we don't get this.
I agree with you in the sense that, you know, there's probably a lot going on here. And we don't have a proper society here. I mean, hell, we have Donald Trump for president. We don't have this. So, like, we just don't understand, you know, the rules here.
So, if you're an English listener, please email us and let us know what's going on.
Yeah, and, like, what the proper way to do this would be. I think you just poison his rose, right? Isn't that what you do? If you're the lady of the manor?
I mean, if this was America, you would go to him and pay him not to enter it.
And buy his story.
Buy and kill it. Catch and kill the Minis Miniver rose story.
Yeah.
We're really hating on Trump today, but that's every day, so that's whatever. So in the next scene, Vin sees Carol at a local dance, and he pulls her aside and apologizes for his behavior because he got very uppity and then left. She forgives him, and they hit it off, and he asks if he could write her. This is the fourth time I turned this movie off because I thought it was so abrupt that this happened. It's really not that bad, honestly, but at the moment, I was like, I'm so annoyed at this film.
So the movie does take a long time to get started. I don't think any of this helps it. It's not particularly interesting, but, well, we'll get into that in a minute. I want to pause and put everything that's happened into context as well. So again, we were talking about this. There were a lot of changes happening in English society with the role of the lord and lady diminishing. So we see this played out in the gardening contest, you know, like a commoner would dare to challenge a royal, you know, like that is probably unheard of until then. And Vin is back from college. He's caught up in the drama of the war that's raging across Europe. He was in London, so he probably heard lots about it. A large portion of the country seems to be ignoring this and continuing on as if nothing has happened because no one thinks it'll actually come to England. This is, again, we see played out in the community. They're having a rose growing contest and going shopping. When the film was released, the war had already struck the UK. America's current stance on the matter was similar to the people we see in the film. It doesn't really affect me. That's the context that we have set up just now. But again, the downside is it took 50 minutes to establish all of this, and it really should have been done in about 15.
I would say it should have been done in maybe 10. It took a long, long time to get to this point. Four stops. This is the record for the Award Winners podcast. I might average 2, but 4 is a ton.
We touched on this too a second ago, so I think this might have been intentional. Again, so you kind of lull your audience into this false sense of security, like nothing is happening, people are moving about their lives while ignoring everything that's happening outside of the country and this war raging in the rest of Europe.
I mean, I understand it. I just don't care for it.
I kind of agree, because it's a waste of my time. It's already a 2+ hour long movie, and they probably could have chopped out a large bit of that right there.
I mean, if you look at it, though, like in our context, I think we aren't watching it when it came out, so we're trying to get through this film, right? But when it came out,
yeah,
it might be significantly more gripping because of the historical context of it.
I actually was reading reviews of this, too, and they said the same thing. Incredibly boring setup.
That's funny. I read one, and I think it by Variety, they were talking about how they didn't think the third act lived up to the first two-thirds of the movie. And I was very confused because I was like, what? It's the other way.
It's a slow start. I think I sent you one of those articles, too, like a review from, you know, the 1940s. It's just interesting to read what they had to say, too, but it largely mimicked what Dave and I are saying. Really slow in some parts and inconsistent in the acting. What happens next, Dave?
So on a Sunday morning, everyone is at church and they're going about their normal business when suddenly their lives are interrupted by news. The country is at war.
So this is interesting, too, because someone comes into the church and interrupts the pastor who's giving a sermon, and the pastor says, "We're at war." So, Dave, in an age of cell phones, how would this scene actually play out?
So, one, someone's definitely going to be on their phone in church. And then when they say that they're at war, I feel like everyone's going to pull out their phone and start going through it, looking at Twitter, looking to see the reactions. People are probably calling out things in the aisles, just saying, "Oh, here's what I saw." And then they probably all rush out. What do you think would go on?
Probably something similar, I guess. I'm trying to remember like where I was for the latest big moment in American history, and that last one was probably 9/11 for all of us, which is kind of pre-technology in a way. We had cell phones, but we had really basic cell phones. Like, we had some text messaging. Not many people were even doing that yet.
You mean SMS?
Yeah. That's the same thing.
For our young listeners, that's the same thing.
So, like, you know, it even took a while to spread in that way, right? Where were you on 9/11?
So on 9/11, I was actually asleep. I had worked until midnight the night before, and my mother woke me up, and she's like, "You need to come see this." And she didn't say anything. I remember a feeling of just complete confusion happening immediately. I saw one of the towers fall. I think it's the second one. And immediately my mom sent me out to go get gas. Later on, I came back after getting gas. She's like, "I can't watch this anymore." And we went to lunch. I have described this, and maybe I've even described this on the podcast, but it was completely silent. We were in a full restaurant. Everyone was there, and no one was speaking. It was completely silent, and everyone just ate their food and left. So everyone was in shock.
I was actually with Isaac, and we had gone up to Toledo to go to an exhibit at an art museum up there. There's a Star Wars traveling exhibit. That's the kind of people we are. No one was in the museum. We actually just listened to CDs on the way up. We didn't even turn the radio on. We left kind of early, I think, maybe 7 in the morning. Didn't know until about noon. We were going to buy some CDs for our return trip. Like, we went into a music store. And they had taken out a little TV, like one of those tiny ones that had like a radio built into it. And we saw like the smoking ruins of New York City. I had someone call me a few minutes before that and say to me, it wasn't my dad, by the way, or my parents. No one called me to check how I was doing. It was another friend of mine. He's like, they hit the Twin Towers. They're gone. And they've also hit the Pentagon. And I was like, what are you even talking about? Those aren't even in the same city. And then I hung the phone up on this person because he was known for pulling pranks. You know, then saw the TV, right, with the smoking ruins of New York City, which was, like, stunning. And then everyone was doing, like, 100 on the highway on the way home. Cops were out everywhere, not pulling anyone over. Since Dayton, Ohio has one of the largest Air Force bases in the country, all the fighter jets were taken off out of there. And we were just hearing, like, sonic booms constantly.
I'm thinking a little bit about your question, how people react now to dangerous situations when they don't have information. Back then, we had to literally call people, right? It wasn't instant. So I was thinking about how when there was some box trucks, terrorist acts in New York City, within literally 15 minutes of it happening, I was receiving text messages from friends across the country. So everything's just significantly more sped up now. And I guess it's cliche to say, but we're significantly more connected as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess everyone would know pretty much instantaneously. You could turn on the news and just watch everything. So from there, things escalate kind of quickly. Finn joins the Air Force, and he proposes to Carol. So the line between the gentry and the plebeians kind of blurs a little bit more, so we're seeing that kind of disappear, the difference between regular people and high society. And again, this is just new for the time. And then Finn is sent off to defend London from German bombers. We see a couple interesting things in those couple scenes. We see an on-screen kiss from an unmarried couple, which I don't think we'd seen before, so times are changing. We also see Vin's little brother put him on blast for not proposing to Carol. So they're around the dinner table, and the little brother's like, Vin, are you going to get married to What's-Her-Face? And then Carol steps in and says, well, I'm just waiting for him to ask me. And then he just does. So how do you feel about little brothers putting you on blast and forcing you into a marriage proposal?
I don't like it. Can I revise my earlier statement saying that I hate Vin? I actually hate this little kid. I don't think he can act.
I thought he was like the humor in the movie, and I kind of appreciated some of his moments, but I agree. He's 5. Like, of course he can't act. On a side note, so again, I was up in New Jersey this past weekend, and the people I was staying with, they're not married yet, and there's definitely a little bit of tension in the sense that she's like basically waiting for him to ask and like drops a lot of hints at it. So, like, I'm feeding the fire being like, oh, what kind of wedding would you like to have? while hanging out with both of them. Like, well, what's your ideal wedding? Like, that's what I was doing.
That's amazing. I did want to point out something. Did you notice that the couple, Mr. and Mrs. Miniver, didn't sleep in the same bed?
Yeah, like two beds right next to each other.
Yeah, so in one sense, this movie is probably paying attention to the Hays Codes, but also then the unmarried couple's kiss on screen. So there you go.
We talked about this before. You probably sleep better.
Yeah, my grandparents do it. I'm sure they like it. They have their own rooms.
All right. So now we also see how the war affects other people in town. So we see that people are sent off to join the war. Bunkers are built. Relationships are affected. Rations are put into place. The town is bombed several times by night raids.
John, I have a completely off-the-wall question for you.
Okay.
What's one food item that, if you're rationing, you personally have to have? It's like your one thing.
Circus peanuts.
I'm surprised you didn't say hot dogs.
A hot dog. The one thing that I would want, if it were rationed, the things that I would like go out of my way to get my hands on.
Yes.
Mangoes.
Really?
Maybe.
Hmm.
What about you?
I am thinking about it right now. Things that I would absolutely love if I would freak out if I got or had them taken away from me. Dried cranberries. I know that's kind of weird, but I have a lot of dried cranberries and I eat them all the time.
I'll trade you a pack of dried cranberries for a mango.
Yeah, okay. This is a good deal. No, this is great. Like, we're going to hang out.
See, this
you
works
have
out.
My mangoes. That's why we're friends. You can have my mangoes, I have your cranberries. We're going to have a great time.
How is it that you don't like mangoes? Who are you?
I don't typically like tropical fruit. I don't like mangoes. I don't like papaya. I'm sure there's other ones that I can't think of off the top of my head. I just typically don't like them.
Hmm. All right. Moving on from there, Mr. Miniver and his boat are summoned by the Navy. So Mr. Miniver, late one night, gets this call, goes down to the dock, takes his boat down the river to London, and it turns out he has been asked to participate in Operation Dynamo, which is, Dave?
Dunkirk.
Dunkirk, that's right. So it's the evacuation of the British troops from the beaches of Dunkirk by a civilian flotilla. And they moved more than 190,000 Allied troops from the shores of France back into England over a few days and nights.
Amazing story. Always fun to hear about it. This scene was strange for me. And that's because I felt like everyone came in very cavalier about being summoned in the middle of the night to go on a raid. I know they didn't know what they were doing, but they still seemed very cavalier.
The way it was set up, they didn't really talk about what it was. Like, it took us a while to even figure out what they were doing. But they come back and all is well. But I have to say, again, just I want to shout out to those two movies, Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour. Both two excellent films, really, about the same situation. So those came out last year. Go check those out. As Mr. Miniver is out at Dunkirk, the Nazi planes are continuing to come over to London, as it seems. One is shot down, and this pilot escapes into the British countryside. As Mrs. Miniver is out for a walk, she spots the pilot in the bushes. He's passed out. He has his pistol on the ground next to him nearby. She kind of quietly walks over and bends down, starts to reach out for the pistol. The pilot wakes up and basically takes her hostage. They are now in her home, so they've moved back to her house, and he is eating everything he can. He's probably been evading capture for a few days, and he's actually kind of seriously wounded. So it looks like he's about to leave the house when he passes out from the wound he sustained. Mrs. Miniver comes over, grabs his gun, hides it, and then calls the police. Pilot wakes up a little bit later. Mrs. Miniver actually tries to comfort him. She picks him up off the ground, puts him in a seat, gives him a little more food. And it turns out this Nazi pilot is like a total zealot. Like, he's all about the final solution, killing people, and having the Nazis take over the world.
I'm finished, but others come, like me. Thousands, many thousands, better for all of this. You want to see me? You will see. We will come. We will bomb your cities. Like Barcelona, Warsaw, Narvik, Rotterdam. Rotterdam we destroy in 2 hours.
Thousands killed. Innocent
people. Not innocent. They were against us.
Women and children.
30,000 in 2 hours. And we will do the same thing here. Even like the least minor.
So, the Nazi pilot shouts that he will kill everything and the Germans will destroy England.
So this is probably the most well-known segment of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after that, the police show up and take the pilot away. As this movie was being developed, which was prior to the U.S. entering the war, the director, William Wyler, was told by a studio executive that the German fighter pilot, shouldn't be made out to be a Nazi zealot, as the Germans are not our enemies, is what he was told. And we don't want to demonize all Germans. As the movie continued, Pearl Harbor happened, and then that studio had changed his mind about the scene. The scene was reshot several times as the U.S. came closer and closer to entering into the war with Germany, and each time that German pilot got more zealous and more violent. And it ultimately culminated with Mrs. Miniver slapping that pilot, which we see in the film. And we also see that Mrs. Miniver shows compassion on her enemy in this. We didn't really see that about the Japanese at the time. They were often shown as and talked about being complete savages.
So this is like an area I can actually talk about, is portrayal of the Japanese in media. So my thesis was on Superman comics during the lead up to World War II and immediately after, and how those comics both reflected and influenced our society. And what I talked about in my thesis was that Japanese at the time were dehumanized on purpose to show them to be less than human, and they were shown negative qualities such as being cowardly, sneaky. And the idea in all these comics was that if they were to take on America head on, they would never win. So they have to go through subterfuge in order to defeat us. Yeah, so I just want to give a little aside out there because I never get to do it.
Yeah, there you go. And then I spent a few minutes trying to see if there was any moments where something like this happened in England. It did turn out that German pilots were shot down and evaded capture for several days in the English countryside, but I did not hear about any situations, or I couldn't find any situations, where something like this occurred. Just on a random side note, I found that one Nazi pilot got confused in a dogfight, and he flew the wrong direction, so he ended up flying north instead of back over the channel, thought he was back home, and landed at an English airport, and then he was immediately captured. He gave the British their first glimpse at the technology behind the Nazi fighter planes, which are actually early versions of jets, and that helped the English sort of reverse engineer the engines.
That reminds me of a story my grandfather used to tell. So he, in World War II, drove artillery. He was behind the line, and he said that one time he got confused and drove into a Nazi-controlled town. He drove into the middle of town, made a U-turn, and then drove away, and no one stopped him.
Sometimes everyone's just so dumbfounded. You're just like, what?
Yeah. They're like, well, let this guy's an idiot. Just let him go. Like, no one actually wants to be in the fight, right?
I think there's probably some truth in that, too. Like, depending on where you are in the war, like, at a certain point, it's clear, like, who's going to win or if it matters or not. So then we see Mr. Vandenberg come home from Dunkirk a few days later. And he passes right out, just goes right to bed. He's been up several days shuffling troops back and forth, or just mostly in one direction from France back to England. He does not even find out what's happened at home for several days when Mrs. Miniver sort of lets it slip that she had a Nazi over for ham and eggs.
Then it is in the papers.
About Dunkirk?
Yes.
Yes, dear.
Thank heavens. I shan't have to tell you about it.
Kim, I'm so proud of you.
And come to think of it, I'm a bit proud of myself. What you might call a real bit of navigation. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Oh, darling, I'm almost sorry for you, having such a nice, quiet, peaceful time when things were really happening. But that's what men are for, isn't it? To go out and do things while you women folk look after the house.
Yes, dear. Come in. I'm sorry, Mum, but I just remembered we ain't got any ham.
What?
You give it all to that German pilot.
Oh, well, never mind, Ada. We've got some bacon in the house, Mr. Miniver likes it just as well.
All right.
What's all that about a German pilot?
Oh, nothing, dear. Nothing at all.
What do you mean, nothing at all?
Well, I just had a German pilot in for ham and eggs this morning, that's all.
What? Wait, say, what's going on here?
Now, Ken, don't get excited. Just going to draw a bath.
I've had a bath and I'm not excited.
Well, have a cigarette?
No, I don't want a cigarette. Was it the fellow we were looking for?
Yes.
But what did you do? A woman you're driving me crazy. Didn't he have a gun?
Yeah, he had a gun.
Well?
I just took it away from him and called the police.
The more I think about this, the more I get sort of infuriated with parts of this movie, because I feel like they don't express how they're feeling internally a lot of times. It's all just like sort of everything's difficult, but we're all like happy-go-lucky and getting through this.
Like she's not totally shaken up by this or anything like that. There is a scene after the police come and collect that Nazi soldier. They do ask her if she is all right, and I think that is a roundabout way to say, like, did he hurt you? Were you raped? And She says no. So, again, it's probably, like, reading between the lines of Code Era films. This just reminded me, like, sometimes we're absorbed in our own bullshit so much that we just forget, like, what else is happening outside of our view. So, like, with Mr. Miniver, he comes home and just assumes that everything is quiet back home, when really his wife is like this hero who captured a Nazi.
I mean, we're all the center of our own little universe.
For sure. So then there's these scenes of bombing runs. The Minivers are basically hanging out in their bunker that they've built outside of their house. In the evenings, bombs are coming over, and they basically destroy part of the Miniverse house. We also see in one of these scenes that they have this vent set up in the bunker to allow air in and out. If gas starts coming through, the vent color is supposed to change, at which point they're supposed to seal it up so that hopefully not too much of whatever the poison gas gets in. And if they're unlucky, they then suffocate in there because there's really no other air coming into this, like, airtight bunker. So, like, there really isn't a win in any situation here.
That's probably the scariest scene for me throughout the entire movie, because that kind of hit home. They're trapped, essentially. They just can't do anything, so you have to hopefully they get lucky, essentially.
So then Vin comes back from his tour of duty in the Air Force. He and Carol get married and go on a honeymoon. They come back just in time for the annual garden party and rose competition. The garden contest happens, with Lady Belden getting word that her rose has won the contest. As the host of the party, it is her job to announce the winner. She actually decides to change the outcome, announcing that Mr. Ballard has won. So she's kind of had this change of heart. She's won all these years, and this means a lot to Mr. Ballard, it turns out. So he's very happy that his rose, which is a very good rose, as everyone says, has won.
I do want to make a note here. The Miss Miniver is a real rose. It was not at the time when this movie came out, but it became a real rose, and it's known for being dark red and very fragrant.
Okay, so then an air raid siren goes off, and Vin is called to service immediately. Mrs. Miniver and Carol drive Vin to the airbase. On their way back home, it's gotten dark out. They are caught in an attack by the Germans. So above them, there's this dogfight happening.
They seem to be fighting right over our heads.
And we see this plane crash. Basically, it's on fire and flies right over them and explodes. And it's a British fighter plane. Carol immediately starts worrying that it's Vin. But Mrs. Miniver tries to assure her that it hasn't been long enough for him to get up in the air, so it can't be him. They decide to drive a little bit more, and they just ultimately stop. Planes are overhead. This plane is fighting with another plane in a dogfight, as I was saying. It fires a couple times. Mrs. Miniver, still in her car with Carol, looks over at Carol and is like, "Are you okay? I think the car was just strafed. I think some bullet holes are, you know, here and there." And she actually sees that Carol is hit. And I actually think this is a brilliant moment in cinematography. There's this bit of light coming through the bullet holes in the roof of the car on to Carol, in a way, kind of just showing you the path of the bullets. It's a powerful scene, so she takes her back to the Miniver's residence. Mrs. Miniver has called for an ambulance, but as the town is being bombed, everyone needs the ambulance, so Carol kind of just slowly bleeds out and dies.
Completely shocked by this turn of events. I also think this is probably the best scene in the film. I was really engaged throughout this entire thing. I also think it was sort of a nice setup where they sort of set it up for Vin to get killed, and then they inversed it, had Carol.
Yeah, I think it's unexpected. And again, I really think that cinematography is excellent there with the light coming through the bullet holes, like the moonlight coming through those bullet holes showing where Carol was kind of struck. Brilliant. The final scene is then the town church with some parishioners missing as they gather for a service. We see that people killed in the air raid were Mr. Ballard and several others within the community. So Mr. Ballard had just won the rose competition. And the camera pans back, showing that the church is a shell of what it used to be. It's a physical representation of what the destruction has been within the community. There's no roof, some of the walls are missing, but people are still there, still coming together. And then the movie ends with the pastor giving a very impassioned speech, saying that we must all work together in a time like this.
We, in this quiet corner of England, have suffered the loss of friends very dear to us, some close to this church. George West, choir boy, James Ballard, station master and bell ringer, and the proud winner, only an hour before his death, of the Belden Cup for his beautiful Miniver Rose. And our hearts go out in sympathy for the two families who share the cruel loss of a young girl who was married at this altar only 2 weeks ago. The homes of many of us have been destroyed, and the lives of young and old have been taken. There's scarcely a household that hasn't been struck to the heart. And why? Surely you must have asked yourselves this question. Why, in all conscience, should these be the ones to suffer? Children, old people, a young girl at the height of her loveliness. Why these? Are these our soldiers? Are these our fighters? Why should they be sacrificed? I shall tell you why. Because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform. It is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the factories and on the farm, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom. Well, we have buried our dead, but we shall not forget them. Instead, they will inspire us with an unbreakable determination to free ourselves and those who come after us from the tyranny and terror that threaten to strike us down. This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us, and may God defend the right.
This speech was a none too subtle plea to American audiences to get involved with the war and support their allies across the sea, because war would eventually come to the United States, and the same destruction would happen to in America if they did not get involved.
Very hammer over the head.
For sure.
Not subtle at all. Also abrupt. It was just like, and this happened. Oh, by the way, here's a speech. Done.
I also like this moment where the Lady Belden, who is, again, the aristocracy of the town, and we see Vin on the other side of the church with his family. He moves across the aisle at the very end to join her, showing that, like, you know, he's still going to be there for her, and kind of coming across the aisle, again, showing this breaking down of royal society, but also that he is out to help the country and other people. Nailing that hammer in, but I think it's a very good and emotional scene because Mrs. Belden has just lost her granddaughter, Carol, Vin's wife.
Yeah.
Movie discussion, Dave. Can movies motivate people into action? As we talked about earlier, this movie basically helps sway the American public's opinion and convince them that they needed to join the war effort.
Yes, movies can persuade people to action, but it's multiple different things. It's your opinion, your thoughts are changed slowly over time using multiple forms of media. But really it comes down to, yes, movies can cause and affect change.
I agree. I think we saw this in different ways too. So you and I took this Nazi film propaganda class in college. We saw how film was used to change the public's opinion in the wrong direction. You know, there's all these movies that were put out to make people feel like the Jews were the root of all evil. You'd walk out of movies being like, man, those Jews like really are jerks. You and I watched some of these movies and they were incredibly, it was like amazing how they could make you feel walking out of it and plant those ideas in your mind. And this definitely motivated people to action.
With that in mind, when you're on Twitter, pay attention to propaganda.
That's right.
I don't think I need to say any more.
One of the interesting things we saw in the news recently was that I forget which branch of the government or which agency within the government is going to start alerting us to propaganda pieces put out by foreign governments.
That's interesting. I didn't hear that.
It was just the other day.
So basically 70% of Twitter.
Right. So what do you think it would be like living in a place that was under the constant threat of bombing?
I have a hard time imagining it, but I have to assume it would be incredibly numbing. I mean, it reached a point where it probably happened so much that you just don't feel anything. I personally struggle with, you know, being trapped. I don't like small spaces. So the idea of being trapped in a small place where you're also potentially going to die is completely terrifying to me.
Yeah. We saw a couple movies about this recently. I think so last year or 2 years ago, there was the movie The White Helmets. And then the year after that, there was another documentary basically continuing the story of The White Helmets. Seeing those two movies in a relatively short period of time, you can see those people change. Because they've dug so many people out of buildings and lost so many friends and even been in some bombing attacks themselves. They just kind of expect to die at any moment.
I can't imagine that. We're very lucky to be in the United States and not have to deal with these type of situations.
Yes. So why do you think this movie won Best Picture?
So ultimately, I think that it's a propaganda piece, essentially. The acting's fine. The story is not great, but it's fine. And I think this won because it stirred the emotions of people in the country at the time. They saw this and realized that they were speaking directly to America. Essentially, I think it was just at the right place at the right time. I don't think it's probably not the best movie of the year. It just happened to be.
I haven't seen the other movies, and you haven't seen many of the other ones either. So this could be.
Haven't, but I have read. I read reviews of them, and everyone's like, "This is considered one of the weaker wins."
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah. So I kind of agree with you that I think this movie, out of the context of World War II raging on in Europe, would probably not win Best Picture. It's definitely a moment in time. The whole war in Europe was in the cultural zeitgeist. I think not knowing what was going on in the world when this movie was released would make it seem like a questionable choice for Best Picture. So you and I watching this out of that context of 1942, it wouldn't make sense. And it kind of doesn't. Again, to your point, it won because it was the right movie for the right time in the right place.
Can a propaganda movie be considered a Best Picture because the propaganda is so good? It takes skill to produce a movie like that, like, is what I'm trying to say.
So good that it convinces people to act in certain ways, or?
Like this movie is designed to be a propaganda movie, and it's so good at being a propaganda movie that people recognize it and award it because of that.
When we say propaganda, Wyler definitely had an opinion and was trying to push people to act in a certain way. Is that considered propaganda? I mean, in a way, but it wasn't trying to subvert anything. I feel like with this movie, had this movie not come along, we would all potentially be Nazis right now, Dave. You know what I mean?
I'm sure it played into stirring up some emotions to get everyone ready.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying, yeah, but it's not one-to-one again.
Yeah. Okay. So at the onset of our podcast, we talked about a lot of people in this film were nominated for their roles. What did you think of the acting in this movie?
I really liked Carol. I didn't really care for anyone else. Like, I didn't think there was a ton. I mean, Greer was fine.
I kind of agree. So, like, the acting, while not bad, is not great either. So, winner or wiener?
I think we're going to disagree on this. I think that it is a wiener. If you could cut that first hour out, I would say watch this movie. Otherwise, just don't. You can skip it. There's only two scenes that I was really, really invested in, and that was the Carol's death and then Miss Miniver catching the Nazis.
So I agree that the movie is a very, very slow start. And you could probably even skip over the first, like, 40 minutes, maybe just tune in every minute or two, and then start the movie there, and you'd basically still understand what's going on. But I do think that it captures a very specific time and a very specific feeling. And it was also historically important for helping bring the U.S. into the war. Say what you will about that. I'm not a warmonger. I don't want us to go to war, but sometimes it's necessary. I think it's important for these reasons. The dialogue is punchy sometimes and maybe a bit uneven, but that's meant to lighten the mood of another otherwise like very serious, heavy movie. So I do kind of think it's a winner ultimately, even if it's not perfect.
I have one gripe. Why isn't this just called The Miniverse and not Miss Miniver? Because I feel like the movie's about all the Minivers.
Like Mrs. Miniver? Well, there's two Mrs. Minivers, I guess, the point of that, too. So there's one that dies and then one that makes it through, and the duality of all that, I suppose.
Okay.
And it also means the rose.
So, do you have any feedback for us? Because I don't. I haven't heard anything.
You and I did a G.I. Joe episode a few weeks back. And I asked the question if kids still played with action figures today. Mike, one of our listeners, said that his kids do, in fact, play with action figures. They even have a laser printer and make their own together. So he and his daughters, like, use a some kind of, like, 3D printer or something like that. And, like, they design little monsters or something like that. And he helps them print it out.
That's amazing. Side tangent. When I was little and I had my G.I. Joe figures, you know, you can't afford all the figures, right? So you have like 10. I would take them apart and put them back together in different configurations to create new G.I. Joes to do different storylines.
When we used to break the rubber bands in the G.I. Joes a lot, and my grandfather would replace them with hair bands, which are like way better. Like, how did you take them apart and put them back together?
You unscrew the screw in the back. I would use rubber bands, sometimes hair bands, but I would change out their legs and their arms and their heads and just create some Franken Joe is what I called them. That was just the Joes I would play with until I got bored, and I would remix them after that.
Cool. So what do we have up next, Dave?
All right, so it is audience choice. We are going to do a family drama, and the options are Ordinary People or Kramer vs. Kramer. According to IMDb, Ordinary People, the accidental death of the older son of an affluent family deeply strains the relationship among the bitter mother, the good-natured father, and the guilt-ridden younger son. Kramer vs. Kramer. Ted Kramer's wife leaves her husband, allowing for a lost bond to be rediscovered between Ted and his son, Billy. But a heated custody battle ensues over the divorced couple's son, deepening the wounds left by the separation. So we are doing family drama. And I should say, while you're voting on that, we are going to be prepping The French Connection. So that is our pick.
Awesome. Yep. I guess. I don't know.
We'll I've seen The French Connection.
I have a while ago. And my We'll save it for the episode.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about the French Connection. Yeah. So, if you like our podcast, remember that you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Instagram, you can email us at john or david@awardwinners.com. You can go to our website and check out all the content that we're putting there. And John, I think you have an announcement for the listeners.
Yes. We have one listener who has not stopped bothering us about the Titanic and has asked us to do it. So there are two ways to make this happen. One, you make sure that we have 50 reviews on iTunes, 50 five-star reviews, let's say. Dave, what are we at right now?
Just 50 reviews. The 5 stars is never going to happen.
Okay.
We're at 12 reviews.
12 reviews.
That's not all 5 stars.
The other way to make this happen is become a patron of ours. So we have a Patreon site set up, and I have a Titan tier level of patron set up, which is donating $1,000 a month to to us. So if you sign up for that. I have agreed to let the Titan level people get first access to the Titanic episode. We'll record it and give it to you before everyone else.
Wait, so it's every month $1,000 for one episode.
That's right.
we gotta work on that.
No. It's the Titan level. That's the only level we have, by the way. On
it's the only one? We don't even have like a dollar like support the podcast.
I think you can choose your own thing. I don't really know enough about it, but I just went right for the Titan one. For the one person who's harassing us to sate his need, if he wants us to do the episode, it's $1,000 a month until we get it done. Probably be at least 3 months before it happens. So,
okay, well, let's see if it happens.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. It's great hanging out with you, and we'll catch you later.
The light that you shine can't be seen. A man can tell you so much he can say. You remain my power, my pleasure, my pain, baby. To me, you're like a grown addiction that I can't deny. Won't you tell me, is that healthy, baby? But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become a light and the light that you shine can't be seen? Kissed by
bridge by a road on the bridge. There is so much a man can tell me, so much he can say. You remain my power, my pleasure, my pain. To me, you're like a grown addiction that I can't deny. Now won't you tell me is a healthy baby? But did you know that when it's night, my eyes become large and the light that you shine can't be seen? Yes, I can pay you to a kiss from a rose on the grave.